The topic at hand today is biomolecules or biological molecules. Biological molecules obviously are molecules that you find in biological systems, or otherwise known as organisms. Now, when you just use the phrase biomolecule, or the word biomolecules, or the phrase biological molecules, neither one of those says anything about the size of the molecules. So biomolecules could be big or small. You just find them in organisms. But some of those biomolecules are fairly large molecules, and that's why we use the different word, macromolecules, specifically for large biological molecules. We call them biological macromolecules. And although there's many different examples, any given biomolecule, biological macromolecule falls into one of four categories. So what are those categories? Lipids is one. Carbohydrates is not one, even though the manual incorrectly says that it is. The manual's wrong about that. Carbohydrates is a huge category of molecules. Carbohydrates contain carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, but there are both big carbohydrates and small carbohydrates. Right? For instance, glucose, that's a monosaccharide, and it's therefore a carbohydrate. All monosaccharides are carbohydrates, but monosaccharides are not big molecules. So glucose isn't a macromolecule, even though it is a carbohydrate. Only some carbohydrates are actually macromolecules, because they're big as well. And we make those by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides to make what? Polysaccharides. That's one of the four classes of macromolecules. So, and carbohydrates is bigger than that, right? Some carbohydrates are polysaccharides, some carbohydrates are monosaccharides. Only the polysaccharides are big molecules. Yeah, and that makes them big compared to glucose. All right, so that's two macromolecule classes. What are the other two? No, those are not big molecules either, really. Those are just two small sugars hooked together. But they're also still carbohydrates. What did you say? Yeah, proteins is one. Now, well, I'll have more to say about proteins in a second. What's the fourth one, though, before we get into that? Nucleic acids, right. And why do we call nucleic acids nucleic acids? Exactly. Nucleic means of the nucleus. And as long as we're talking about a eukaryotic cell, which has a nucleus, that's where you find the DNA, and DNA is an example of a nucleic acid, right? A bacterium, of course, has its own DNA, but it doesn't have a nucleus, but that's why they were called that. That's where you find the DNA. And so nucleic acids include both DNA and RNA, of which there are different types. So those are the four. Of those four, only three of them classify as polymers. One of them doesn't. Polymers are large molecules that you make by hooking together a bunch of subunits called monomers. Mer just means part. So a monomer means one part. Polymer means many parts together. Which one of those four macromolecule classes is not made that way? Is not a polymer? Think about the subunits that these things are made out of. Proteins are polymers. So you're down to three now to choose from. Nucleic acids are polymers. That gives you a 50-50 chance now. What did you say? Glucose is one specific example. It's not a category. And it's not a macromolecule anyway. It's a carbohydrate, but it's a small molecule. It is lipids. Lipids are not polymers. The other three are, which means in the other three cases, those big molecules are made by hooking together a bunch of the small subunits. So in the case of polysaccharides, what are those monomers called? Monosaccharides, right. You make a polysaccharide by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides. What about proteins? Amino acids are the monomers. And so when you hook together two amino acids, what do you call the covalent bond that hooks them together? That's the process. What do you call the bond between two adjacent amino acids? We call that a peptide bond. Okay, when you hook two amino acids together end to end, you have to use a peptide bond to do that. And therefore, if you do that several times using many amino acids, you make a bunch of peptide bonds, right? One between each adjacent pair, which is why when you have a long string of amino acids, it's called a polypeptide. Now, the word polypeptide and the word protein sometimes mean exactly the same thing, and they can be used interchangeably, but not always. Depends on the context. A polypeptide, the word always refers to a single strand of amino acids arranged end to end. So one polypeptide has two ends to it. And some proteins that's all they are, is one polypeptide, and it folds up into some shape, but it still is one strand, it has two ends to it. And in that case, for those kinds of proteins, they mean exactly the same thing, protein and polypeptide. But there are some more complex proteins that are called multimeric proteins. Once again, that mer means part, so a multimeric protein means it consists of multiple parts, not just the amino acids. The multimeric proteins consist of more than one polypeptide. Hemoglobin is a good example of that. It's actually four different polypeptides, four separate ones, that remain as polypeptides. So I'm not talking about making a protein by hooking polypeptides together end to end. If you did that, you would just make a bigger polypeptide. All of these constituent polypeptides remain as individual strands, each with two ends, but then they're held together by hydrogen bonds and other forces. If that's true, that multimeric protein, we use the word protein to mean the whole thing, and polypeptide would just refer to one subunit within that protein. Okay? And then polysaccharides are also monomers. Nucleic acids are also polymers. What are their monomers? I didn't hear you. No, those are not the actual monomers. That's actually smaller than the monomer itself. She said nitrogenous bases. That's actually just part of one monomer. Nucleotides is the name of the monomers. So when you take several nucleotides and arrange them end to end, you make a nucleic acid, but you could also call that, another word that means exactly the same thing is polynucleotide, because it consists of many nucleotides. All right, now, RNA usually exists as just a single polynucleotide. It's one strand. DNA usually exists as a double-stranded molecule, right? Technically speaking, it's two individual molecules, just like the individual polypeptides within hemoglobin. DNA really consists of two polynucleotides that are complementary to each other and are held together by hydrogen bonds. But when we say one DNA, that's really what we're referring to. Two molecules held together, each of those molecules is a polynucleotide. Yes, that's really two polynucleotides, just like one hemoglobin contains four polypeptides. Now, speaking of the nitrogenous bases, by the way, that's actually even smaller than the subunit polynucleotide, I mean, a nucleotide is the subunit. A nitrogenous base is even smaller than that. A nucleotide qualifies as being a nucleotide if it has three parts to it, one of which is some pentose sugar. Pentose simply just means it's a five-carbon sugar. And so that five-carbon sugar, or pentose, is ribose in the case of RNA, and it's deoxyribose in the case of DNA. But connected to that pentose are two different things, hooked on at different places. One of those is a phosphate group, at least one, and the other one is a nitrogenous base, of which there are different kinds. Adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, uracil, those are all nitrogenous bases. Okay, so nitrogenous base, sugar, and phosphate together make up one nucleotide, and then millions of those strung end to end make up a DNA, which is why it's a polymer. Now, making these large molecules, these macromolecules out of smaller things, whether you're making a lipid, whether you're making a polymer or a lipid, if you're making a big molecule out of smaller pieces, you don't get to do that for free. It takes energy to do that. And that's what you spend some of your energy doing, building your macromolecules up from scratch, basically. On the other hand, if you break down a big molecule into smaller chunks, you not only get those smaller chunks, but that releases some energy, some of which can be captured to do some work, which is how you get energy out of the food you eat. You digest that food, break it down into small enough particles that you can get some energy out of for store as ATP, some of which can be spent to build brand new macromolecules once that stuff is in your cells of your body. Now, the two types of reactions that the manual discusses are opposites of each other, but no matter which four of these macromolecule classes we're talking about, if you have two pieces that need to be hooked together, one of those pieces will have a hydroxyl hanging off of it somewhere, which is an OH group. And we can use R just to denote what stands for residue, which just means the rest of the molecule. Okay? So this is one piece. Another piece will have a hydrogen hanging off of it somewhere. And when you get these two pieces together, what you're really doing, I'll make it R prime just to say that it's in a different piece right now. What you're really doing is hooking the rest of this molecule with the rest of this molecule. And when you do that, you eliminate the OH and the H, right? Which is why you not only make the bigger molecule out of the two pieces, but left over you have H2O. That's why water comes out of that situation. And that's why joining two small pieces into a bigger chunk is done by what kind of reaction? What do we call the reaction? Dehydration, because you're removing water from the situation. Another word means exactly the same thing, refers to exactly the same reaction, is condensation. Dehydration or condensation are the same reaction. That is exactly the reverse of having a big chunk and breaking it into pieces. And that is a hydrolysis reaction, because exactly the reverse happens. If you're going to break these two pieces into this one piece into two chunks, you can't leave this bond unformed. So you have to stick a hydrogen onto one and an OH onto the other to satisfy their valence. The source of the H and the OH is water, so it requires water to split a big molecule, and that's why it's called hydrolysis. Lysis means split, splitting. Hydrolysis means splitting via water. Okay? Well, the purpose of today is really just to run a bunch of tests that will determine whether or not some molecule of interest is present in an unknown solution. So it's often useful to say, you know, if you don't know exactly what's in a solution, it's sometimes good to know whether it has any monosaccharides, for instance, or whether it has any protein in it. So there are various tests that you do today. One test involves Benedict's solution, and it's called the Benedict's test. It's a test for what we call reducing sugars. Reducing sugars are monosaccharides. Monosaccharides, though, which is just a simple sugar, right? A one-piece subunit, like glucose, for instance. Any given monosaccharide can exist in either in what's called an open chain form or a circular form, cyclic form, a ringed form. And it can go back and forth. As long as it's a monosaccharide by itself, it can go back and forth between ringed and open chain form. But when it's in its open chain form, you'll find somewhere in that carbon skeleton that it's made out of a carbonyl group. And does anyone know what the carbonyl functional group is? What's in it? And what between them? A double bond, exactly. So you have a carbon somewhere in the carbon skeleton, double bonded to an oxygen. Now there's two major possibilities here. This carbon that's part of the carbonyl group could be at the tip of a carbon skeleton, somewhere at the tip. I say a tip because a carbon skeleton can have many branches to it. But if it's at one of the ends somewhere, then we can say R for the rest of the carbons. And then this carbon will also have a couple hydrogens connected to it. Just one. So it has four bonds being made. If that's the case, if the carbon of the carbonyl is at the very tip somewhere, then that makes that compound an example of an aldehyde. The other possibility, though, is that the carbon of the carbonyl is not all the way at the tip. It's somewhere in the middle of the carbon skeleton. So you would have a carbon here and a carbon there, for instance. Okay? That is still a carbonyl group, but now, since it's not at a tip, we call this compound a ketone instead. And so any monosaccharide is either an aldehyde or a ketone, depending on where the carbonyl is. And that's why we use two words to describe categories of monosaccharides. They are either ketoses, which is just one word that means ketone sugar, or aldoses, aldehyde sugar. Well, it's the aldehyde group, the one on the top, that is able to react easily with the Benedict's solution. And this is an example of a redox reaction. What does redox stand for? Did you say something? That's what the RE stands for, yeah, the RED. Redox is short for reduction oxidation, or oxidation reduction reactions. They're called that because you can't have one without the other. If there is a reduction of something, something else gets oxidized at the same time. And do you know which is which? Do you know what oxidation and reduction are individually? It's kind of confusing terminology because the word reduce, you typically think of as meaning something you're losing something, right? But actually, reduction is the gain of electrons. Right. You're reducing the charge. But you're gaining electrons if you're being reduced, and you're losing electrons if you're being oxidized. So in any given redox reaction, something has to be oxidized and something else has to be reduced. Well, these aldehyde sugars, or aldoses, are able to be oxidized by losing electrons. And the thing that they lose electrons to are gaining electrons, and therefore the sugar is reducing something else, right? That's why they're called reducing sugars. They're becoming oxidized, but they're reducing something else. What they're reducing are copper 2 ions each one with a positive 2 charge, that are in that Benedict solution. So when a copper 2 ion gets reduced, it's receiving an electron, right? And that's going to transform it into copper 1. That's why it's called reduction. You're reducing the charge on this from positive 2 to positive 1. The reason that's handy in terms of detecting whether monosaccharides are present is that copper 2 ions make the solution blue, copper 1 ions make the solution brick red. And so there's billions and billions of copper ions in there, right? As some of them turn to copper 1, you'll get a gradual change. It will go through a greenish change first. But if you really change a lot of them, which you would if you had a lot of monosaccharides present, then it'll go to brick red. You'll see other colors in between, though. If you see no change at all, it stays exactly the same blue, that means you don't have any monosaccharides. Now, ketoses don't do this, but in the process of doing this test, you heat the thing up, and that can cause ketone sugars to rearrange into an isomer where the carbonyl is now at the end. In other words, it can turn them into aldoses, which then can react with the copper. So any monosaccharide basically will cause a positive result for this test. But if you have a polysaccharide, on the other hand, polysaccharides are formed not by linking together the open chain form, which are the only ones that have this carbonyl. If you have the ringed form, it doesn't have the double bond anymore, and therefore it can't do this reduction trick. And the ringed form are the only kinds that you link together to make polysaccharides. So it locks all those subunits into the ringed form and doesn't allow it to react with the Benedict solution. For instance, if you have starch, that starch is a storage polysaccharide, called a storage polysaccharide because the reason for making it is to store extra glucose for later use. You can store extra glucose when you have more than you need for energy demand. You can store it more efficiently in the form of a polysaccharide rather than leaving individual glucoses on their own. But you do that by linking together the ringed form of glucose, and it can't react. Plants do this. You know, plants make their own food via photosynthesis, but when they have more than they need for their energy demands, they do the same thing that we animals do. They take the glucose and polymerize it, hook it together to make a storage polysaccharide. Plants make starch, which is nothing but glucose, arranged a certain way. Animals like us do the same thing, but when we put our glucoses together, we string them together slightly differently. It's still nothing but glucoses, but it's a more branched configuration rather than starch. Compared to starch, what do we call that? What's the animal form? That's glycogen. Exactly. That's a major function of your liver. When you have extra glucose that's coming into your blood because it's coming through your gut because you've just eaten, the liver takes the glucose out of the blood, strings them together to make glycogen, and then later when you have fasted for a while and your blood glucose level starts to dip again, your liver will totally reverse that process, break the glycogen down into glucose, spill it back out into the blood so that your brain can stay alive, because the brain uses almost nothing but glucose as fuel. Okay, well anyway, that's the reason why you might have sugar. You might know that you have sugar there. But sugar can be a polysaccharide or a monosaccharide. This test will tell you whether it's a monosaccharide or not. Okay? What do we call the test that tests for polypeptides? Would have been a good quiz question, apparently. Or, from your viewpoint, a bad quiz question. What is it called? It's called the Biuret test. Now, really, Biuret is not part of the situation in its normal use. It's called Biuret test, not because Biuret, which is a derivative of urea, which is in urine. There's none of that in the Biuret solution. It's just that it's called Biuret test because if instead of protein you have Biuret there, it will also give you a positive value. That's why it's called that. But you're using that solution to test for the presence of proteins. And what is the color change there? Well, it also starts out blue. It's a different version of blue compared to the Benedict's. But if you have a positive test, which means you do have peptide bonds there, what does it change into? Yeah, a violet color. And so any of these tests, Benedict's, Biuret, or the other two that I haven't mentioned, it's basically a yes or no. So you're not getting any numbers for these. It's not a quantitative assessment. It's a qualitative assessment. But even though it is yes or no, you can also get a feel for how strong the positive is. Like I said, on the Benedict's test, if it changes at all, that's a result. That means, yes, there are some reducing sugars there, but you can get a feel for how much of that solution is made up of reducing sugars by how drastically it changes. If it only changes at green rather than all the way to brick red, that means you have some but not as many as another solution that would change it brick red. Okay? What do we use as a test for the presence of starch, which is a polysaccharide? That is the iodine test, right? And that will turn very dark if starch is present. It should turn it very dark, almost blackish brown. And then you're also, I don't know whether it might be one we skip, but there's also a test for DNA. What is that one called? It's diphenylamine is the name of the reagent. The diphenylamine test will test for DNA. You can have RNA there and it won't react, but if it's DNA, it will. Okay? So those are the names of the tests. It's really just a matter of you doing it. Make sure you read your thing, by the way, each week. But this tells you something that you're skipping. For instance, we are not doing... Actually, this one doesn't, but my version does. We are not doing... Where's my version? Or maybe I can deduce it from this. We're not doing 6.5 and 6.7, I think it is. Okay? We're not doing those at all. 6.4, I think it is. Is that the one with acetone and water? I'm doing that as a demo in the hood, so... Once I set that up, all you need to do is go look at those two beakers. The rest of the sections you're doing, 6.1, 6.2, and so on. So I just want to let you know that even though the manual says we have water baths, we're not using water baths, we're using those heat blocks. So you just put your test tubes in this slot. You need to keep it in there at least as long as it says to keep it in the water bath because it doesn't quite get perfect thermal contact like it does with water, so it needs to be in there at least that long. And also, even though I probably shouldn't have to say this, I'm going to notice that every little vial has its own little sheath to keep that particular transfer pipette in it. Don't mix them up, don't contaminate the solutions. Put it right back in the same sheath as you use it. So you have various things to work with right at your station, but also part of it says that you need to choose a couple unknowns. Those unknowns are up here. It doesn't matter which ones you choose, but just write down which one you're using, which two you're using, however many you're required to do. Just make sure they're different from each other. And then finally, it is not okay to put tubes in this recycling ever. Glass tubes in here. Unless you do this properly. And I want you to put them in here today, but don't do it unless you do it properly. It means that you have to clean them out first. That's one thing. So I don't want to see any colored liquid in them. Use the hood and the spray bottle of water, not the acetone bottle, the Swaltons. Use the big water bottle. Make sure you get all the stuff out of them first. But also, they can't have any tape on them. So if you use tape to label them, make sure you take that stuff off before putting them in here. Nothing but glass in here. All right, that's it.